had three listeners reach out to us this week. Ottawa's Bill McDonald bought Dave Nichols one day for his girlfriend. He added a shout-out for the Sens. Jen gave us props for our enthusiasm for Muriel Spark. She recommends Memento Mori. And Heather Kemp sent us some appreciation specifically for our salty language. Thanks so much, Heather. And she is reading Mary Russell's The Sparrow, and I can give double props for that one. So Bill, Jen, and Heather all found the show by listening to the Books on the Nightstand podcast. So double and triple thanks to Anne and Michael over at BOTNS. This is the Enthusiasticast, the web show where we get excited about stuff and then we tell you about it. This week's special guest, AJ Somerset, is going to tell us why he loves Thomas McGuane's novel, 92 in the Shade. So, AJ, welcome to the show.
Thanks.
You just had a huge book launch. You've launched your debut novel. Congratulations.
Thank you.
You had a big party here in Toronto, and I guess you've been partying. You're from London, and you've been partying in southwestern Ontario as well, I read. So can you tell us about the novel, what it's called, and what it's about?
Sure. The novel's called Combat Camera. And it's the story of a guy called Lucas Zane, who was formerly a very prominent combat photographer and now is burnt out and washed up. And now he's making a living shooting decidedly low-rent pornography. And while he's doing that, he hatches a scheme to try and salvage his career by shooting a photo documentary on one of the porn performers, and she's a stripper named Melissa. And the novel follows their relationship and his attempt to build the story as she's trying to make a fresh start in her life.
So welcome to the First Novel Club. You're in good company this season. There's lots of excellent first novels out there. How did you get here? Like, where? What's your background and what brought you to publish this season?
Well, I guess short version of the story, because you don't want my whole life story right now, is that
I was born, I walked uphill to school both ways. Yeah. You could go there.
I was born at a very young age. I was in the military, and from there I became a technical writer, did technical writing for quite a while and then started writing for magazines, and eventually I decided that I knew enough about writing to try fiction. So I started working on this book about 7 years ago, and finally last year, having reached a peak of frustration with it, I submitted it for the Metcalf Rook Award, and to my surprise and alarm, it won. And so I had it published this year.
Amazing. Now, the Metcalf Rook Award is awarded for the best unpublished manuscript, correct?
Yes, it's an award for an unpublished manuscript.
Which is awesome, because you have an award before you're even published, right? So it's like right on the dust jacket. You've hooked up with Dan at Biblioasis.
Yep.
And that process has gone well, and you're doing promotion for the book right now.
Yep.
So in terms of, so you were in the military, you did some journalism. The Lucas Zane character, the main character of the novel, you know, where did you meet him? How did he come into your imagination? Is this, you know, it's cliche to ask you if it's autobiographical, but essentially how did the story, come together?
Well, it's not autobiographical at all. I was working as a freelance photographer for a while, in addition to freelance writing, and I never did go far as a freelance photographer, but I did a little assignment work and so on, so I got a feel for it. And I was very interested in combat photography. Not that I wanted to go out and do it myself, but I was really interested in the pictures. And I had been following a couple of well-known, prominent war photographers. One is James Noctway, who's considered the greatest contemporary war photographer and possibly the greatest of all time. And he's sort of in all his public statements anyway, is continually gives the impression that he's impelled by a great sense of injustice, and he wants to put a stop to war and so on, and this is what drives his photography. He said he has this idea that photography can be the antidote to war. And I was kind of interested in what can happen when somebody who is sort of kept going for 20 years, is now actually, he's probably been at it 30 years now, for that long, what would happen if that person woke up one morning and said it was all a waste of time? it wasn't worth the effort. And the other guy I was following, who kind of does take that attitude, is an English photographer named Don McCullen, who got his start in the Vietnam War. Was one of the very prominent photographers of the Vietnam War, and now takes the point of view that everything he did was a waste. It didn't achieve anything, and all it did was to ultimately harm the people he photographed by invading their privacy and invading their lives with a camera. You know, at obviously rather inopportune moments. So, you know, taking pictures of people who have just had family members killed and stuff like that. So he was somewhat the inspiration for Zane. But I didn't want to look too closely at McCullen's life. He's got an autobiography, which I didn't read, because I wanted to build Zane from the ground up, just from the idea of this guy who has sort of lost his faith. So from there, I kind of built him from the ground up and invented a career from him.
So I, you know, on this show, we've talked extensively about war memoirs and journalistic memoirs of war, like Michael Hurst's Dispatches. A couple weeks ago, I was really enthusiastic about Sebastian Younger's War, which of course is tied into the documentary Restrepo. So we've kind of had a war-themed show, and then that went away for a while, and now we're kind of back. But you know, how has getting inside Zane's head and, you know, just kind of thinking through that process of disillusionment, I guess, you know, change your relationship to kind of what you're seeing in the news right now?
Well, I guess in terms of changing my relationship to what I was seeing in the news right now, when I started this book, what had happened was I had had this conversation with somebody in which he had compared war photography to pornography, and that's when the idea for the book sort of popped into my head, and I wrote it down, originally thinking it was going to be a screenplay, actually, and put it in a file of things that I might get around to writing one day. And then about a year later, the United States invaded Iraq, which was really what got me started on it. I found my first journal where I was actually working on the idea, and the date is March 19th, 2003, which is the date of the invasion, and the first sentence is, "I am so pissed off." So what drove it was enormous disillusionment over the media manipulation. Zane's a journalist. The media manipulation that went into selling that war to a sizable chunk of the American population. The sense that the journalism can very quickly become something like pornography in that it's selling illusions. That was the original idea behind it. It was a sort of a nasty little polemic about journalism, but it grew out of that as I was writing it. So that's not as present as it once was. So I don't know if it's changed my relationship to what I'm seeing now. It certainly grew out of frustration with what we have been seeing now, or what we have been seeing for 10 years or more on the news.
Yeah, because we kind of entered a black hole where we weren't, you know, we had embedded journalists, we weren't getting, you know, the on the chopper, off the chopper stuff that we saw in Vietnam. That was very deliberate on the U.S.'s part, and it seems like just recently, I feel, we've started to really get that second draft of history about stuff happening in Afghanistan, with, you know, tied back to Tim Hetherington and Sebastian and stuff like that. So
yeah, embedding has that effect. The one of the best examples I saw of the effective embedded journalism on the product that comes out was Christopher Morris, who's a prominent American photographer who was became famous in Bosnia, and he covered the invasion of Iraq and was embedded. And he had taken a picture that was fairly well known of this young Iraqi girl, probably, you know, 4 or 5 years old, crying and covered in the blood of her family members after an American IFV crew opened up with the cannon and wiped out their minivan. His comment on this was that, well, you know, the guys I was with, you know, it didn't bother them that I was taking that picture. I was here to do a job and they knew it. But then later when they get into Baghdad, he had witnessed these guys that he was embedded with breaking into shops in Baghdad and looting. And, you know, they're grabbing cans of Coke or whatever and drinking them and this kind of stuff. Just not large-scale looting, but just basically taking whatever they wanted. And he didn't photograph this. And he said in an interview on NPR that the reason he didn't photograph this was that it wasn't newsworthy. It happened in every war. To which I have to point out that his earlier picture, you know, civilians get killed in every war too. So he chose not to take a photo of the people that he was embedded with that was uncomplimentary to them.
It's Stockholm Syndrome in a way, right?
Yeah, in a way. And then when you move on to something like Tim Hetherington's book that's just out, I haven't seen the book, but I've seen some of the coverage of it, Infidel. There was a feature on it on the New York Times Lens blog, and some of the comments there were really interesting, people lambasting it, because it all shows the activities of this American infantry platoon in the Korangal Valley in Afghanistan. And it doesn't show the enemy, and it doesn't show the civilians, and so on. And so people were criticizing it. But I think that when you look at something like that, on one level, it's rather like the embedded journalism, in that it presents a very one-sided view, which is what embedding is intended to do. But on another level, what it's starting to do is actually show the limitations. It shows why they're not winning in Afghanistan. Because those guys in that outpost in the Korangal Valley, they're supposed to be winning the civilians over, the local population over, to their point of view. They don't ever see them, or they barely see them. They don't really see the enemy. It's long-range sniping. The limitations of the photographs are also the limitations of the soldier's view. So, in a sense, it's giving you an insight into why the war can't be won.
Yes, of course. And the Americans have now pulled out of the Korangal, right? So,
yeah, and probably because they realize that they're really not achieving anything there.
Exactly. So, I don't know. I don't know Thomas McGuane's stuff. He sounds kind of like a cross between Carl Hiaasen, Martin Amis, and Larry McMurtry, I guess. But I was looking at his Wikipedia entry just before we sat down to record, and there was kind of similarity between his choice of names for protagonist and the last name Zane for your novel. I wonder, you know, how did you come to the name Zane for Lucas?
Well, I like names that are a little bit kooky, like a lot of writers do. And basically, I keep a little file filled with possible names, and I like names like Zane and Zach and so on. And I had written Zane down, and I wanted to use it here because it's it alludes to zany, it alludes to sane or insane. So I kind of liked that aspect of it.
Oh, very appropriate. So can you tell us about 92 in the Shade and why you like McGuane?
Yeah, I can. So McGuane has written something like 10 novels now. His latest is coming out this month, and two short story collections. And early in his career, he was being hailed as, I think the New York Times called him, the Hemingway of the drug generation. He was supposed to be the next big thing. And what happened was he changed the style of what he was writing a lot, and maybe that's why he's not better known. But his early novels, and 92 in the Shade is the apex of this, are all characterized by a fantastic use of language. 92 in the Shade, at the level of each sentence is sort of sparklingly original. So the effect of this, especially if you're a writer, is electrifying. What the book is about, I'll give you an overview of it. It's the early 1970s. It's the age of fear and loathing in Las Vegas. And the main character, Thomas Skelton, is lost in a globe of his own hallucinatory despair. And he drops out of the company of junkies and losers and returns home to Key West, Florida, where he intends to work as a flats fishing guide and find some meaning in his life. But there's a guy in Key West called Nickel Dance, who's the top guide in Key West. And he feels that the profession of guiding is overcrowded, and he wants to discourage new entrants. So he's determined that Skelton is not going to be allowed to guide, and neither of them will back down. Skelton's determined to do it. Dance, who has a violent past, is determined to stop him. And so what follows this mano-a-mano showdown of escalating violence as they come into conflict. So it has a big drama in this novel. That's one of the things I like about it. It's not a quiet, muted psychological novel, which is a nice change of pace. It has all of the drive of a thriller. It's also very funny, drop-dead funny at times. And then most of all, the language of the novel is really electrifying. He has a unique way of putting together sentences that he's very specific in his diction, and it's very precise. He's never vague or inflated or puffy. He has this way he builds sentences where, if you look closely at it, what he's actually doing is borrowing sentence structures from the 19th century. A use of semicolons that is, they're very prominent in 92 in the Shade, and the way he uses them recalls Charles Dickens. But his sentences are filled with contemporary language, and he also uses a lot of slang. So it's very contemporary, but at the same time, there's this sense of formality and precision to the way that he writes, which is really unique.
So when you say that there's kind of firecracker language here, is this Tom Wolfe, Electric Kool-Aid Acid Test, Ken Kesey kind of stuff, or is this more is he showing off in that way that I know from Martin Amis? I don't know if you read Martin Amis.
Yeah, he's not Tom Wolfe. I guess the he would be like if Hunter Thompson was a much better writer. And Hunter Thompson is already a good writer, but it's like he's got an overdrive gear that Hunter Thompson doesn't have. So the best thing I can probably do is to read a short passage from the novel, if you don't mind.
Yeah, go for it.
So in this passage, what's happening is that Skelton, who is living in a abandoned aircraft fuselage, has decided to embark on a home improvement project. And he's got a couple other problems nagging at his mind as he shops for home improvement supplies. One is that his father is making advances to his girlfriend, Miranda. But more importantly, Nickel Dance has threatened to shoot him. And Nickel Dance has shot people before, so it's a threat he's going to take seriously. Skelton was modifying his fuselage and shopping in the Sears hardware store for tools and parts. He bought a Craftsman variable speed drill with a firm money-back guarantee. The magic of the electric drill was that it allowed you to take the oddly shaped hole of an electrical outlet and, by running its force through a black cord and silvery mechanism, cause holes at the other end of any size you liked. Would Dance regret his deed Would he look again at that delirious passage by which what is quick and numinous becomes meat and say, "Fooey"? Or would he, like the television commentators before every event, never cease to be amazed? The hardware department, with its bins of galvanized nails, black bolts, and chromium-plated screws, its bright power tools, was presided over by six clerks in green smocks who soared among its counters, from time to time regrouping at the cash register to clinch a sale or to take a quick pull of coffee from a translucent white coffee cup. Skelton knew that, embroiled as he was as a customer, hardware, generally speaking, was bad for the world. It was among the glues, directly behind the epoxy display, to be precise, that he knew it was time to go and see why his father was asking Miranda for a date. The two-part epoxy was best for maximum adhesion between clean, flat surfaces. The one-part mock epoxies were just the thing, a lady clerk volunteered, for simple household repairs, including china, furniture, butter churns, ice skates, and simple treadle assemblies. Sweet Jesus, thought Skelton, not in the least taking the name in vain. Death is in my lane, trumping the passing gear.
Amazing. Okay, so this is like, I have the impression that this is kind of like Southern noir. Am I way off?
Yeah, I think that's a fair way of putting it. There's a noir aspect to it, definitely, because he has this sort of mano-a-mano confrontation in the amongst the palm trees of Key West.
Right on. So my one other question was, you alluded to the fact that he had a big change in style. What happened to him? What did if he was being all experimental with sentence structure and evocative language, did that just go away?
Well, what had happened was two things. One is that he was involved in a car accident after 92 in the Shade, which, and he says that after his car accident, he felt that he was nearly killed, you know, sort of thing. And he felt that there wasn't time to waste and that all the flash he had been putting into his work detracted from the serious things that he was trying to say, which may well be true. The other thing that that happened was he went to Hollywood for several years. He directed the film version, created the screenplay, directed and so on, the film version of 92 in the Shade, starring Warren Oates. And he wrote the screenplay for The Missouri Breaks, which was Brando and Jack Nicholson. And did some other screenplay work and sort of developed a reputation as a wild man. And then quit screenwriting after that and went back to Montana and started writing novels again. But after that period, his novels became much more muted in their language, and he became much more of the psychological novelist rather than the novelist of comic violence that he was before. Although he still has that... there's always the comic aspect, and there's always a dramatic aspect to the way he writes. He's not he never became an internal Anne Michaels, Michael Andacci kind of writer.
Thank goodness. having read Combat Camera, I can see why there's an affinity there, right? Because there are some clearly dark, funny moments in Combat Camera that are kind of like that. Like, I don't know if you cop to that comparison or not, but I'm putting it.
Well, I think
there.
That black comedy, if I allude back to people like Anne Michaels again, I had a moment where I was reading the Globe and Mail online, and they had a feature about this guy in the military whose job it is to coordinate all aspects of the return of bodies of casualties from Afghanistan. And it was a very interesting profile, and I reached for my notebook. I thought to myself, oh, there's something here. And then I stopped myself reaching for my notebook because I realized that 15,000 other aspiring writers in Canada were reaching for their notebooks at precisely that moment. And also because I realized there was no way to make it funny. And I think that life is funny, even in really bleak moments, people find humor. So I think that black comedy is appropriate. And and often has more to tell us than a sort of artificial wallowing in misery. So that's probably why I like Thomas McGuane's novels. They're full of that kind of black comedy, where a lot of other writers nowadays try not to be funny. It's almost as if you start being funny, you won't be taken seriously.
Well, that's definitely a disease in Canadian fiction, but we won't go there and mention any names.
It's not just Canadian fiction. There was a piece in The Guardian today, English novelist making the same complaint, saying, you know, why can't funny novels be taken seriously? Novels were always funny historically, and now all of a sudden in the 20th and 21st century, late 20th and 21st century, we've decided that the novel's not allowed to be funny and it has to be very serious.
It's exercising earnestness.
So who knows why?
Huh. Well, I think that's a cool place to end it. AJ, thanks so much for joining us. That was an awesome recommendation. I'm missing whole periods of, you know, I'm missing that 70s period of American fiction. I know very little about it. So hearing about McGuane from you is awesome and kind of both exposes that hole in my own reading, but also gets me excited about it. So that's cool. Is there anything that you want to plug, like your blog or Twitter or any appearances coming up?
Well, appearances coming up and other information can be found at my blog, which is easy to find, ajsomerset at wordpress.com. And AJ Somerset is AJSOMERSET. All of my readings and so on are announced there.
Sweet, sweet. And you are on Twitter as AJ Somerset, right?
That's right, yep.
Okay, perfect. So, to hear more books from me and for John, who apparently wasn't able to parachute in at the last minute, you can go to iTunes or subscribe to the show on iTunes. If you want to track us down on our blog, you can see that at enthusiasticcast.com or send us an email at hello@enthusiasticcast.com. Until next time, I'm Mark. And you're AJ, and thanks for listening.